Mr. James, reel 16. Right, Mr. James, so if we could continue.
So this ATS girl came in and she said that the general had arrived with his entourage in the village, and he had taken over the big house up the road by the windmill, and he is going to come and get his rations from me. And would I give him rations for 8 every day to further notice? So I said, oh yes, all right, well I'll come tomorrow then. So she said, but that'd be all right. So I remember particularly Lieutenant Van Leeuwen, that we've got the commander, the Southeast Area Commander, General Montgomery, in Winchelsea with his staff cars, and his 8 years girl wants rations for 8. And he wants plenty of sugar, because he loves sugar on his strawberries. So I told Van Leeuwen anyway. And so Bert Newman gave me his rations separately, and she came and collected them from me every day. Well, anyway, it's another thing that's been involved, but anyway, it's day one. So she came back and she said, the general is very disappointed that he should have wanted it, he wants more. Well, I said, I'm very sorry, but I have made up the general's rations a quartermaster has. I says, and there is a scale. I says, and of course, the sugar. I could have more sugar. I said, with the dining hall. But I said, I can't go and demand more sugar. I said, I'm sure that the quartermaster would have given the general his rations. She said, but the general loves a lot of sugar. So I said, well, I said, you can tell the general I've got no more. And then we sold it to the cookhouse. So went up to the cookhouse to see whether I had any complaints during the day. And there was Monty with his officers, his aide-de-camp, and any complaints? Everybody had complaints. What's the trouble? No variety, sir. No variety? There's a lot of stodge every day. Same old dough. What? Is it enough? No, sir. So, you turn to the order officer, he said, what's all this about? Not enough food, no complaints, no variation. He said, I'm going to get 2 Waldorf's cooks from Aldershot here. And they were there by the next day, making all sorts of cream cakes, cream horns, and fairy cakes, and wonderful, all from the other rations, made do miracle cooking, cordon bleu cooking, and they loved it. These sergeant major cooks were there. Of course, the other army cooks, they were just looking on. They were doing nothing. These Waldorf cooks were doing all the super stuff, top shift stuff. And he was there for a long time, and he came a second time before he went. And then one day I saw his cars, his staff cars, go down the hill of the ATS girls there. So we're gone. No more. And down the cloud of dust, away from the village, and I thought, gone, thank God for that. And goodbye, General. We did the happy man, good riddance, but of course, the troops missed all the cream cakes because so did the departure of the Waldorf's cooks happen.
What kind of impression did he make? I mean, obviously, he wasn't General Montgomery at this time. He was just one of a number of high rangers.
We knew that he was in charge of that area for defence. He was the commander, Southeast Area Commander. Mm-hmm. We were in charge of the commander. He was the general in charge of that part of England. So we didn't know, of course, that he was going to fly out the next day. It was the next day, it was in the papers, headlines in the papers. General Vernon Montgomery takes over the 8th Army at Alamein. Mm-hmm. At Alamein, you know, it was unfair to all the other generals who were there. They didn't have enough tanks and arms, and they were really doing their very best, and they had no success at all, because they didn't have enough equipment, didn't have enough soldiers. But anyway, one after the other, you know, Lord Gort and all the others, and all the others, all sort of remember the name, but anyway, they were all one after the other castigated by Churchill and not doing enough to sort of hit Ronald VI, and Monty went out there, of course Monty demanded everything. He had all the tanks he wanted, all the troops he wanted, and he imbued them with a new confidence. He said that he was going to hit up the 6th South mm-hmm. Africa, and he did. In the Battle of Alamein, he took over, and he was given all that he asked for by Churchill, and he had nothing but victory. So that was the beginning. It was the first victory.
Mm-hmm. But at this is all pre-Alamein and pre-kind of Montgomery as a famous personality. Did he make his mark during his time as the general in charge of the Southeast Command?
Did he make his mark? He gave orders that everybody in every battalion, from the colonel down, would do PT every morning before breakfast. And fitness was the order of the day. And everybody had to do PT in the morning. He really did make his mark.
And did that have an... How did that affect people like Bert Newman and the older...
I don't know. I never saw Bert Newman do so, but everybody had to go and do PT early in the morning on orders of the GOC, the Southeast Command.
And so did you find that you had, like, overage people struggling to...
Well, I was a bit young man, personally, you know. I was a lieutenant to them.
But some of your older colleagues...
That's right. Puffing and blowing... Yes, I remember particularly.
Can you?
This chap who was doing PT fairly. Well, I must say that it was very necessary because the fitness wins, you see, and he really turned things around.
So even at this stage, before he was famous as a general, he came across as a man of
who
impressed.
That's right. He was really the number one general in the UK at the time. At this time, I mean, we couldn't see the end of the war. The Americans came in, I think, in December 1941, when Pearl Harbor, December the 6th, I think it was, when Pearl Harbor was bombed. And then the Americans came in, and the Germans had attacked Russia. I, for one, realized that we now had a chance of victory. Mm-hmm. Before then, we couldn't see the end.
Mm-hmm.
We didn't know.
Mm-hmm.
And Bonte made a church bell.
Can you remember who the orderly officer was when he came into the dining hall that time? Was it the D Company or...?
I can't offhand. I think that... I really can't. Because I remember that there was a great big... the officers who made the company commander from there to, you know, to the dining hall.
And that was Johnny Whalen?
Well, Johnny Whalen, yeah. And Balance.
Mm-hmm. Right. He was C Company commander at that time. Yeah.
And then they went along.
What do you think Monty was doing in the area at this time, then? What was he?
He was preparing to go to Alamein. He came to this delightful little place called the Gypsy, where he knew the Durhams were, to prepare his journey and to give him a week to get things thought out for the 8th Army. Because he left Winchelsea for Alamein. He flew out the next day and was there the next day, in charge at El Alamein from Winchelsea. So he must have been doing his preparations in Winchelsea.
Mm-hmm. Was this about the time that the battalion had its battle school established?
Yes.
Could you describe that? And what
well,
that, what
well
that
I mean, I think Major Lizard and Sergeant Major Wales and one or two of the others were in that. But I knew that they were doing these small exercises, you know, down at campus hands, but I didn't personally see Major Wayland on the wall. I know the photograph taken by the War Office, by the War Office.
Is that the bicycle platoon and the rafts and so on? Those
that's right,
yeah.
That's right. I know that that was, I didn't have personally.
You didn't encounter those press officers at that time?
I knew that it could happen like that, you know.
What about the... some of the other veterans have mentioned an exercise early in your time in Winchelsea where you turned night into day, where you worked during the night and you slept during the day and you got your breakfast at midnight and so on.
That is another vague, very vague recollection. That really, I know it happened, but I can't remember particularly much about that, apart from the fact that your body would sort of change and all sort of thing. But I can't quite remember much about that, to be honest with you.
What about the arrival of Colonel Ware in May 1942?
Yes, so was it May 42, was it?
Yeah, according to the battalion history. Yeah.
That's right. Well, anyway, Dickie Ware then must have taken over from Cedar Particulari. Mm-hmm. That's right. Well, I remember particularly, he was a dapper chap. And he had his officer's hat on, cap on, and about fore and aft, Dickie Ware, a very smart chap, and a very nice, friendly, affable chap, very nice.
Mm-hmm.
And he interviewed everybody. He interviewed all his senior NCOs and had his photographs taken with some.
Mm-hmm.
And he was a lovely man, a good man. I was very surprised to read his obituary the other day that he died aged 100. So he must have been born in 1899 or 1898, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And at that time, therefore, in 1942 or 43, he must have been about 45 or 46 years old.
Mm-hmm.
But he was a very nice chap.
Did his style of leadership differ from Murray and Seaborne Montefiore?
He was a professional. He had done sterling work in World War I, I think. And he'd won honours in World War I, so he was he knew what war was all about. He had had experience in war, from what I've read.
Mm-hmm.
And that makes a big difference, I think.
Would you have seen much of him in Winchelsea?
I saw a lot of him, actually, from time to time, because he made it his duty to sort of be everywhere.
So he would be coming round to look at what was going on
right,
with the different companies.
Right. And say day on, and you could have a cheery word, you know we were, mm-hmm. as well. With all of us in the army, the colonel, the lieutenant colonel, is a fearsome person, because, you know, he's the boss, and everybody respects him. And some people shake at the knees when something like that comes along, because he's number one.
Do any instances spring to mind of your colleagues at that time that were scared of
him? I think some of the officers, you know. Some of the ranks as well. I mean, we aren't all made in the same clay.
Mm-hmm.
But there were some who sort of tried to dodge authority or anybody like that if they could.
Mm-hmm. Now, around about this time, RSM Thomason, you said, turned up.
Yes.
And did he bring a different style to
Yes, he did. He was a tall chap, tough-looking chap, agile. You could see he was an athlete. You could see that he was tough. He was well-built. He had a commanding presence. He was smart. He had hands like big hands. And he was a watcher, too. But he was very friendly. And he was a down bloke. And he was new. And I was always anxious to talk to these new chaps, especially when they were in authority, because they could affect your life, you know, and I got on very well with them. I liked him a lot,
mm-hmm.
and I think that he liked me as well,
mm-hmm.
because whenever I saw him, and all through with the 16th in North Africa, and at Salerno, places like that, and afterwards in Milan when I met him, he had nothing but a friendly handshake with me, mm-hmm. A smile and nice words. You know.
Didn't you tell me off the tape that there was some kind of friction between him and one of the other NCOs when he first arrived?
Yes.
What was that?
Yes.
What's the story behind that?
You know, it's the army, and we had, as I say, we had our devils from Bedford, but as I said, Sergeant Mattin, he was a real devil maker. He was very adventurous, and for his size and for his build, you know, you would think that Button was a good fighter as well.
Mm-hmm.
And he quickened himself very well in battle. Sergeant Mattin won honors in battle. He won. He was very good, and he had nothing but praise from his commanding officers. That just shows you that I'm right, that he was a damn good soldier, but he was also, as well, devil may care. He wasn't going to be spat on by anybody. And I dare say that he probably fought. When there was a little argument with Thomason one day, that you could handle Thomason. And I think there's a little bit of disobedience, and which came to fisticuffs. And Arles and Thomason really killed him. And I saw the fight.
And you remember what the argument was about?
It was about personality clashes, mainly. And Matthew wasn't going to sort of, wasn't going to say kowtow down to him from Durham. I think that. But I think that Matthew thought that he was good enough as well to stand up to him, but he wasn't.
And how did this fight take place? Was it like a formal encounter?
It was off parade, I remember. It was in the evening. It was, it wasn't, Thomason would have booked him in a regimental way, even though it was off other miles.
So they would arrange to meet at a certain point.
It was outside, yes, right. And I remember particularly that this fight happened and Thomason, back didn't have a chance.
And there wouldn't be any spectators for this.
And after that, great buddies. Well, we are, because he was a sergeant at that time. He was provost sergeant at that time. Later, RSM Thompson had him as a company major. And he was well thought of. Excuse me.
Now, in terms of C&D Company, we're at Winchelsea, so it would have been possible to notice possible differences in the way that the company commanders and the CSMs ran the companies. Do there any differences spring to mind between Whalen and Balance, or between Broadhead and
Pearson? Joe Whalen was a tall, gangly, easy-going chap from Gloucester. Very well spoken. He spoke regularly and all sort of thing. And in university, he was a youngster as well. He was tall. But Balance was a stern-looking, aquiline bloke, aggressive almost, and that was the difference. And Whalen, although he was quiet, and he was, after all, let's face it, he was Captain Whalen, but then he was, before that, not long before that, he was a lieutenant, Whalen, and then he became a major later. But he was liked. He wasn't aggressive. He could be nasty in his own way. He gave me a bombing for wearing a fountain pen when we were going to have our photographs taken. And told me that I shouldn't be walking about with a fountain pen sticking out of my backwards pocket. Although I was using this pen all the time, and I absentmindedly put it in the top pocket, and I forgot it was there, actually, when we were going to have this photograph taken. But he wasn't going to have it.
That was Johnny Whalen.
That's right. And so he took me to task, and I was hurt at the time, and I thought it was a foul. Yeah.
Do you think the ordinary soldiers would have preferred Whalen to Balance? Was there any difference?
I think so, because he was easier. He was easier. He was also, at times, very kind. We had a bloke who got drowned accidentally at Winchelsea. His name was Corporal Price. And he was Welsh. He was a marvellous singer. His song, "Trumpeter, what are you sounding now?" was very dramatic. And he had quality voice. He could have been in the halls. We went swimming in Winchelsea, incidentally, down in the marshes around Camber Castle. And the weeds caught his foot and he jarred, and everybody knew him, and he was a fine big chap. It was a shock, it was terrible. Then he was drowned, and the whole of Winchelsea boys felt it. And they sent his body home by rail, and I had to get down to the station to accompany it to the station to see the train off.
ashamed to see the box. It was a rough old box. But Gil Whelan was very, very sorry about it, and he asked me to go and apologize to the next of kin of Corporal Price, whose address was Derry, D-E-R-I, in South Wales, only about 6 miles from where my parents lived. And I was going down there on leave the following week, but lo and behold, Joe didn't realize that Corporal Price was married and was living in Birmingham. The people in Derry were his relatives. Brothers in the Air Force, and his sister-in-law. But no, the fort was there.
Did you notice a difference between, so there was a contrast in balance, Major Balance's style and Johnny Whelan's style. Was there a difference between Arthur Pearson and George Broadhead, the two CSMs?
Yes, absolutely. Arthur Pearson was a dynamite infantryman. He was always on parade. He was on parade when he was off parade. And as I said, he did the hell with chaps in the D Company. And I had a little conversation with him. I told him, you know, that keep his nose in his own company and so on. And he never forgot that. But he was, no doubt about it, like a new pin, Arthur Pearson was. But George Broadhead was an easygoing, ex-Bedford Sergeant Major, which incidentally I remember when I was a young new recruit. I was under the wing of George Broadhead when I was newly Private James on the range at Washington Butts, learning how to shoot. And George Broadhead was in charge of the rifle butts, and in charge of us, and in charge of me, and taught me how to shoot. And he was a crack shot himself, incidentally, which is his failing, because in battle he stood up, and if anybody showed himself, he would have had him.
Yeah, we'll get to that when we move forward to Tunisia. Yeah.
Poor George Broadhead was a different man. He was easygoing. He was a smiler. And he was my sergeant major. And I did my job. And he did his job. But he was very friendly to everybody. Everybody loved him. They knew that he wasn't a menace.
Did he have a nickname?
Pardon?
Did he have a nickname?
No. Sergeant Major Broadhead was Sergeant Major Broadhead, and his wife used to follow him wherever we went. Wherever the battalion went in England, his wife was a young woman with a little girl, and George knew he was going next, and he'd arrange accommodation for his wife, and so he was living with his wife all the time, and his little daughter. And it made him happy, I suppose, but he was a nice chap, he didn't have the need to impose CB or punishment on anybody because they did what he wanted. And he had no problems. They were a good crowd in D Company.
Did Arthur Pearson have to, or did he employ those tactics then, do you think?
Well, Arthur Pearson, of course, he wanted to be the Sergeant Major of everybody, actually. When he walked up to Winchester, you know, he would... everybody would be in his watchful eye. D Company as well, everything wrong. He took advantage of the fact that he knew that they feared him. But he therefore began to check D Company chaps as well.
And what would he check them for? What?
Take hands with your pocket plan. Yeah, and things like that. General stuff like that, he'd be a bit of a nuisance. Whenever you'd see him, you'd go, you know, he'd went out. But George Broadhead, no, he was a special bloke, I must say. But I couldn't have worked at it with Arthur Pearson, really, personally. George Broadhead was very easy to work with. And midlife, all that much easier, in fact, later on. When we went to Camberley, we were together in the billet.
Yeah, we'll get on to that. In terms of because of your specific job, you mentioned off the tape that you you were able to observe the offices of the two companies at quite close up as well. And any details of the offices besides the two company commanders that stick in your mind between the two companies?
Oh yes, yes. I mean, the officers were changing as well. In D Company, there was Kaufman, Lieutenant Kaufman. First of all, you know, and he was a Jewish chap, very nice chap, short. And short legs. And he had his belt loosely adjusted and his revolver would be hanging down, even like a cowboy, walking, you know. And but in action, he shot a German also right through the two guys.
Yeah,
this is Kaufman. He wasn't, the upright sort of Sandhurst, elegant sort of tall officer. He was a gangling sort of short chap, but there you are. He was, you remember him because, he was Lieutenant Kaufman. Duffy, he was another chap. He was from Middlesbrough, I think. He was another chap, he was. He was a young chap. And I didn't realise, first of all, that he's an ex-guardsman. But he was one of the young officers under Wayland, that I knew would do well.
Mm-hmm.
And he was a big built chap, a handsome chap, but he was very easy going as well. Always a nice smile. But here he sees it. Hello, colour. Everything all right, colour? To me, you know. He didn't even sense it, but there was a greeting there. Mm-hmm. And, he wasn't sort of a haughty officer. But, young Lieutenant Elliot, I remember him now in D Company, and all the others. But anyway, I still remember, of course, and observed the officers in C Company, the Lieutenant Duck, remember him. And as I say, I sort of know them all by sight. Purposely sort of didn't involve myself in C Company affairs, you know, but I knew them all and I saluted them. Everybody went in through the front door. There was C Company on the right, company office, and my office was top of the stairs, Wayland and mine.
Do you think there was could you detect a difference in the way that the different platoons were ran? You know, the different sergeants and the different platoon officers?
I would think, really speaking, yes. But that's right. There would be. Jeff Emerson was a very good sergeant. He was a good soldier, and he had a good attitude.
Mm-hmm.
And although he didn't appear to be light-hearted, he appeared to be very serious in whatever he did. He had a very good platoon, actually. Mm-hmm.
And who were the other sergeants at that time?
Charlie Bray,
mm-hmm.
and there was Dick Walker,
mm-hmm.
In D Company, and there was this other chap whose name was King, Dapper chap in the moustache. So there was Charlie Bray, of course, and Sergeant McDonough, you know.
Mm-hmm. And Charlie Bray was an ex-Bessonhearts man as well.
Charlie Bray was an ex-Bessonhearts man, and he was between Sergeant at Winchester. And of course, with Charlie Bray at Winchester, I remember particularly, and I didn't realise until he reminded me of the memory, because I was the Q-block, he could get a steel helmet to fit him. He had a big head, a very big wide forehead, and we couldn't have a steel helmet from anywhere to fit him. Bert Newman couldn't do it, and I'd forgotten about all this, but Charlie reminded me. And he had to get his from either the fire service or the ARP. Can you believe it? But yes, I remember. Yes, well, Charlie Bray, very well. I never thought of years later, you know, we'd meet as we did.
Mm.